Toxin by Robin Cook. Continued. Cassette 7, Side 2. Not only is the line moving too fast, these guys are hardly even looking at the carcasses as they whip by. Kim suddenly caught sight of Jed Street nosing around the eviscerating tables and sinks. Kim recommenced his sweeping with his push broom. He moved away from Jed in a counterclockwise direction and soon found himself in the decapitation area. The beheading was done by another saw, only slightly less appalling than the saw used to cut the carcasses in two. Just before the spine was completely severed by the man wielding the saw, another man caught the 100-plus-pound head with a hook dangling from the head conveyor rail. It was a process that required coordination and teamwork. Continuing his cleaning efforts, Kim followed the line of the skinned heads. With their lids gone, the lifeless eyes gave the heads a curiously surprised look as they clanked along. Kim followed the head conveyor to a point where it disappeared through an aperture into an adjoining room. Kim immediately recognized the room as the place where he'd been attacked Saturday night. Glancing over his shoulder, he looked for Jed. When he didn't see him in the pandemonium, Kim took a chance that Jed wouldn't miss him and walked through the doorless opening into the head boning room. "I've come into the room where the heads go," Kim said into his microphone. "This is potentially important in how Becky happened to get sick. Marcia had found something in the paperwork about the head of the last animal on the day the meat for Becky's hamburger might have been slaughtered. She said it was revolting, which I now find curious, since I find the whole process revolting." Kim watched for a moment as the head conveyor dumped a head every 12 seconds onto a table where it was attacked by a team of butchers. Knives, similar to the ones used to slit the animals' throats, quickly cut out the huge cheek muscles and the tongues. The workers took this meat and tossed it into a 2,000-pound combo bin, similar to those Kim had seen at Mercer Meats. "I'm learning something every minute," Kim said. "There must be a lot of cow cheeks in hamburger." Kim noticed that after the cheeks and tongues were removed, the cow heads were pushed onto a flat conveyor belt that dumped them ignominiously into a black hole that presumably led to the basement. "I think I might have to visit the basement," Kim said reluctantly. He had the sense that his childhood fear of basements would be put to the test. So far, it had been a good day as far as Jed Street was concerned, despite its being Monday. He'd had a great breakfast that morning, had gotten to work early enough to sit and have a second cup of coffee with several of the other supervisors, and had had to face fewer absenteeisms than usual. Finding and keeping decent help was Jed's biggest headache. With none of his key day employees having called in sick, Jed was confident that his team would have processed close to 2,000 head by the lunch break. That made Jed happy because he knew it would make his immediate boss, Lenny Stryker, happy. Jed slipped out of his white coat and hung it up. Wanting to catch up on his paperwork, he'd retreated to his office with his third cup of coffee of the day. He walked around his desk and sat down. Pen in hand, he went to work. He had a considerable number of forms that had to be filled out each and every day. Jed hadn't been working long when his phone rang. He reached for his coffee before picking up the receiver. He was relatively unconcerned about getting a call so late in the morning and could not imagine it would be particularly serious. At the same time, he knew there was always a chance. Being in charge of something as potentially dangerous as a kill floor, he knew that disaster was never far away. "Hello," Jed said, overemphasizing the first syllable. He took a sip of coffee.
"Jed Street, this is Daryl Webster. Do you have a moment to speak with me?"
Jed spat out his coffee, then scrambled to wipe the brew off his forms.
"Of course, Mr. Webster," Jed sputtered.
He'd worked for Higgins and Hancock for 14 years, and during that time, the real boss had never called him.
"I got a call from one of Bobby Bowe's people," Daryl explained. "He told me that we've employed a new slop boy just today."
"That's correct," Jed said. He felt his face heat up. Hiring illegal aliens was tacitly condoned, while the official policy was that it was forbidden. Jed hoped to God he wasn't going to end up being a scapegoat.
"What's this man's name?" Daryl asked.
Jed frantically searched through the papers on his desk. He'd written the name down, although not on any employment forms. He breathed a sigh of relief when he found it.
"Jose Ramirez, sir," Jed said. "Did he show you any identification?" Daryl asked. "Not that I recall," Jed said evasively. "What did he look like?"
"He is a little strange looking," Jed said.
Jed was confused. He couldn't fathom what difference it made what the man looked like.
Could you give me an idea? Darrell asked.
Kinda punk, Jed said, trying to think how his 14-year-old son would describe the man.
Bleached hair, earring, tattoos, leather pants.
Is he a fairly big guy? Darrell asked.
Yeah, over 6 feet for sure.
And he has some stitches on his face.
Yeah, he did, Jed said. How'd you know that, sir?
Did he say where he was living? Darrell asked.
No, and I didn't ask, Jed said. I have to say he's been quite appreciative of getting the work. He's even agreed to work a shift and a half.
You mean he's working tonight? Darrell asked. As part of the cleanup crew?
Yep, Jed said. We had someone call in sick just this morning.
That's good, Darrell said. That's very good.
Good job, Jed.
Thank you, sir, Jed said. Is there something you'd like me to do or to say to Mr. Ramirez?
No, nothing at all, Darrell said. In fact, keep this conversation of ours confidential. Can I count on you for that?
Absolutely, sir, Jed said.
Jed recoiled when he heard the line disconnected. It had been so precipitous. He looked quizzically at the phone for a second before hanging up. Not wanting to be caught in the head-boning room where there was nothing to sweep, Kim had retreated back to the main kill floor. He still had no clue as to what Marcia was talking about when she mentioned that last head, now that he'd followed the trail through most of the plant. The only unknown was what happened to the heads after disappearing down the black hole. Kim went back to the evisceration area and re-swept parts of the floor he'd already cleaned several times. The frustrating part was that, in certain areas, it only took about 15 minutes to look like he'd never been there. Despite his earplugs, he suddenly could hear a sustained, raucous buzz. He straightened up from his work and looked around. He immediately saw that the cattle had been halted in the chute. No more animals were being killed. The pitiable cows close to the executioner had been given a momentary reprieve. The executioner had put aside his tool and was in the process of coiling the high-pressure hose. The animals that had already been killed advanced through the line until the final one had been eviscerated. At that point, the line was stopped, and the tremendous din was replaced by an eerie silence. It took Kim a few moments to realize that part of the silence was due to his earplugs. When he took them out, he heard the noises of the power tools being stowed and a buzz of animated conversation. Workers started swinging down from the catwalks, while others used stairs and ladders. Kim stopped one of the workers and asked him what was going on.
"No speak English," the worker said before hurrying off.
Kim stopped another. "Do you speak English?" he asked.
"A little," the man said.
"What's happening?" Kim asked.
"Lunch break," the man said before hurrying after the first.
Kim watched as the 100 or so workers streamed from the catwalks and lined up to pass through the fire door. They were en route to the lunchroom and the locker area. An equal number of employees came from the main boning room via the head boning room. Despite the pall of death and the stench, the camaraderie was evident. There was much laughter and friendly jostling.
"How anyone could eat is beyond me," Kim said into his microphone.
Kim saw the man who'd attacked him along with his partner. They walked by without a glance to join the ever-lengthening queue. Kim felt even more confident about his disguise. Kim stopped one of the eviscerators, whose damp white coat had become variegated with shades of pink and red. He asked the man how to get to the basement. In return, Kim got a look that suggested he was crazy.
"Do you speak English?" Kim inquired.
"Sure, man, I speak English," the eviscerator said.
"I want to go below," Kim said. "How do I get there?"
"You don't want to go downstairs," the man said. "But if you did, you'd go through that door."
He pointed to an unmarked door with an automatic closer mounted on its upper edge. Kim continued sweeping until the last worker had passed through the fire door. After all the noise and chaotic activity when the line was in operation, it was strange for Kim to be alone with 40 or 50 suspended, steaming carcasses. For the first time since Kim had arrived, the floor around the evisceration area was free of gore. Putting his broom aside, Kim walked over to the unmarked door the man had pointed out. After a quick glance over his shoulder to make sure he wasn't being observed, he pulled the door open and stepped inside. The door closed quickly behind him. The first thing that Kim was aware of was the smell. It was 10 times worse than the kill floor, which had sickened him so quickly earlier. What made it so awful was the added stench of putrefaction. Although he retched a few times, he didn't vomit. He assumed it was because his stomach was empty. Kim was standing on a landing above a flight of cement stairs that descended into utter blackness. Over his head was a single bare light bulb. On the wall behind him was a fire extinguisher and an industrial-sized emergency flashlight. Kim yanked the flashlight from its brackets and turned it on. He aimed the concentrated beam down the stairs, revealing a long flight descending to a deep cellar. The walls were stained with large, Rorschach-like blotches in brown. The distant floor looked smooth and black like a pool of crude oil. Kim got one hand free from his rubber glove and located his earphone. After removing his earplug, he slipped it into his ear.
"Can you hear me, Trace?" Kim said. "If you can, say something. I just put in my earphone."
"It's about time," Tracy said irritably. Her voice was loud and clear despite Kim's being surrounded by reinforced concrete walls.
"I want you to come out here immediately."
"Whoa," Kim said. "What are you all wound up about?"
"You're in this slaughterhouse with someone who tried to kill you twice," Tracy said. "This is ridiculous. I want you to give up this madness."
"I've got a little more investigating to do," Kim said. "Besides, the knife guy hasn't recognized me, so calm down."
"Where are you?" Tracy asked. "Why haven't you put your earphone in until now? It's been driving me crazy not to be able to talk to you."
Kim started down the stairs. "I can't risk the earphones except when I'm alone," he said. "As to where I am at the moment, I'm heading down into the basement, which I have to admit is no picnic. It's like descending into the lower circles of hell. There's no way I could describe the smell."
"I don't think you should go into the basement," Tracy said. "I like being able to talk with you, but it's safer if you stay in a group. Besides, you're probably not supposed to be in there, and if someone catches you, there'll surely be trouble."
"Everybody's at lunch," Kim said. "Being caught down here is not my worry." Breathing through his mouth to help avoid the stench, Kim reached the bottom of the stairs. He shined the flashlight beam around the vast, pitch-black space. It was a warren of vats and dumpster-like containers. Each was connected with a duct that led upward through the ceiling to catch the blood, unwanted guts, and discarded bones and skulls.
"This is where they store everything until it gets trucked to the rendering plant," Kim said. "Obviously, from the odor, it's all in various stages of decay. There's no refrigeration down here. Although it's hard to imagine as bad as it smells now, it must be worse in the summertime."
"It sounds disgusting," Tracy said. "It's hard to believe that waste like that would have any use."
"The renderer turns it into fertilizer," Kim said, "and, disgustingly enough, cattle feed. The industry has forced our unwitting cattle into becoming cannibals."
"Uh-oh," Kim mumbled as he felt a shiver descend his spine.
"What's the matter?" Tracy demanded anxiously.
"I just heard a noise," Kim said.
"Then get yourself out of there," Tracy said anxiously.
Kim shined his light in the direction of the noise. In a fashion strikingly similar to the episode in his own basement the night before, a number of pairs of diabolically ruby eyes stared back at him. A second later, the eyes disappeared, and Kim caught sight of a group of animals the size of house cats scampering off. Unlike the night before, they weren't mice.
"It's okay," Kim said. "It's just some monster rats."
"Oh, that's all," Tracy said sarcastically. "Just a group of friendly monster rats." Kim stepped out onto the cellar floor and discovered that not only did the floor surface look like crude oil, it had approximately the same consistency. His boots made a rude sucking sound each time he picked up his feet.
"This is certainly a nightmare image of post-industrialization," Kim commented.
"Cut the philosophizing," Tracy snapped. "Come on, Kim, get out of there. What on earth are you doing down there anyway?"
"I want to find the chute for the heads," Kim said.
He slogged forward among the tanks and vats, trying to estimate where the head boning room lay above. He came to a concrete block wall, which he assumed was contiguous with the wall above. That meant the chute he was looking for would be on the other side. Kim shined his light along the wall until he located an opening. Walking down to it, he ducked through. He shined his light around this second space. It was smaller than the first and cleaner. It also had what he'd guessed. To his immediate right was a chute connected to a particularly large dumpster.
"This looks promising," Kim said. "I think I found it. It's about the size of a construction dumpster."
With the flashlight beam, he followed the chute up to where it penetrated the ceiling. He estimated the diameter of the chute to be about the same as the aperture he'd remembered above.
"Okay, wonderful," Tracy said. "Now come out of there."
In a second, Kim said. I'm going to see if I can look inside. Kim stepped over to the rusted, filthy, dumpster-like container. In this area of the basement, there was no sucking sound as he walked. Around the side of the container, near where the chute was attached, was a small metal platform accessible by four steps. Kim climbed up. He could now see the top of the dumpster. Right in front of him was a hatch, secured with a metal latch. He moved the latch to the side, but then couldn't open the hatch, at least not with one hand. Putting the flashlight between his knees, he got both hands under the edge of the hatch. With a squeak, it lifted. Holding it with his left hand, he raised the flashlight with his right and shined it inside. It was not a pretty image. The container was almost brimming with rotting, skinned cattle heads. In contrast with the newly slaughtered, bloody heads upstairs, here the eyes were shriveled and the attached shards of gristle were black. In many of the heads, the gaping hole made by the air gun was plainly visible. Disgusted by the view as well as the smell, Kim was about to lower the hatch into place when an involuntary cry of horror escaped from his lips. The flashlight beam had found a particularly gruesome sight. Partially buried by a subsequent avalanche of fresh cow skulls was Marsha's severed head. The shock caused Kim to let go of the heavy hatch, and it slammed shut with a deafening crash in the confined space. The booming sound echoed repeatedly off distant, unseen concrete walls. "What happened?" Tracy demanded frantically. Before Kim could respond, a horrid screeching noise tortured both Kim's and Tracy's ears. The crashing hatch had activated some automatic machinery. Kim snatched up the light and shone it in the direction of the dreadful noise. He saw a rusted steel overhead door rising. Kim could hear Tracy repeatedly demand to be told what was going on, but he couldn't answer her. He truly didn't know. Behind the rising door was a filthy forklift vehicle that suddenly came to life like a horrible futuristic mechanical creature. Red lights on its front began to flash, washing the room with the color of blood. As soon as the overhead door reached its apogee, the driverless vehicle began to give off high-pitched, intermittent beeps as it rolled forward in a thunderous, jerky fashion. Terrified of the imminent collision, Kim leapt from the platform and pressed himself against the wall. The forklift crashed into the dumpster, causing a boom even louder than the sound of the slamming hatch. The dumpster shuddered and then raised. As the forklift backed up, the chute connecting the container with the headboning room above became detached. When the dumpster was completely free from the space, a second, empty dumpster, waiting next to the first, slid into place with another thunderous crash. The chute automatically snapped into place. The forklift stopped, pivoted, then rumbled off into the inky blackness. "Kim, I don't know if you can hear me or not," Tracy shouted, "but I'm coming in." "No," Kim cried into his microphone. "I'm okay. I inadvertently activated some automatic removal equipment. I'm coming out, so don't come in." "You mean you're coming out here to the car?" Tracy asked hopefully. "Yes," Kim said. "I need a breather." It wasn't that Derek Lootman didn't trust Shanahan O'Brien, but he knew there was more to this aggravating story than he'd been told. Besides, Derek had a set methodology in his work. Killing people was a business in which one could not be too careful. Rather than going directly to Kim's former wife's house, as Shanahan had initially suggested, Derek went to Kim's. He wanted to test the reliability of Shanahan's information, as well as learn more about his supposed quarry. Derek drove into Balmoral Estates and directly to Kim's property without hesitation. He knew from experience that such behavior was far less suspicious than cruising the neighborhood. Derek parked in the driveway in front of the garage. He opened his metal Zero Halliburton valise that was resting on the passenger seat next to him. Reaching in, he pulled out a 9mm automatic from its custom-cut pocket in styrofoam. With trained ease, he attached a silencer and then slipped the gun into the right pocket of his camel hair coat. The pocket had been altered to accommodate the long weapon. Derek got out of the car, holding his ostrich briefcase. He took a quick peek into the garage. It was empty. Then he strode up the front walk, appearing for all the world like a successful businessman or an elegant insurance adjuster. He rang the bell. Only then did he glance around at the neighborhood. From Kim's porch he could see only two other houses. Both appeared unoccupied at the moment. He rang the bell again. When no one answered, he tried the door. He was surprised but pleased to find it unlocked. Had it not been, it wouldn't have made much difference. Derek had the tools and the expertise to handle most locks. Without a moment's hesitation, Derek entered the house and closed the door behind himself. He stood for a moment, listening. There wasn't a sound. Still carrying his briefcase, Derek made a rapid, silent tour of the first floor. He noticed some dirty dishes in the sink. They looked as though they'd been sitting a while. Climbing up to the second floor, Derek saw the splintered door leading into the master bath. He took in the broken console table. Stepping into the bath, he felt the towels. It was clear that none had been recently used, so at least that much of Shanahan's information seemed accurate. In the walk-in closet in the master bedroom, he glanced down at all the clothes littering the floor. He couldn't help but wonder exactly what had gone on during the botched hit that Shanahan had mentioned. Back down on the first floor, Derek entered the study and sat down at Kim's desk. Without removing his gloves, he began to go through some of the correspondence to see what he could learn about the man he had been brought all the way from Chicago to kill. Tracy had backed up so that she could see along the front of Higgins and Hancock. She'd thought about driving back to the entrance, but was afraid to do so because she and Kim had not discussed where she'd be when he came out. She was afraid Kim might come out one of the other doors and then be searching for her. But she soon saw him emerge from the front door and jog in her direction. He was dressed in a white coat and had a yellow plastic construction helmet on his head. He ran up to the car, and after glancing back over his shoulder, he climbed into the back seat. "You're paler than I've ever seen you," Tracy said. She was turned around in her seat as much as the steering wheel would allow. "But I guess the blonde hair emphasizes it." "I've just seen one of the worst things in my life." "What?" Tracy asked with alarm. "Marcia Baldwin's head," Kim said. "It's probably all that's left of her, along with a few bones. As disgusting as it sounds, I'm afraid most of her must have gone for hamburger." "Oh, God," Tracy murmured. Her eyes locked with Kim's. She saw tears appear, and it made her respond in kind. "First Becky and now this," Kim managed. "I feel so damn responsible. Because of me, one tragedy had to lead to another." "I can understand how you feel," Tracy offered. "But as I've already said, Marcia was doing what she wanted to do, what she thought was right. It doesn't justify her death, but it's not your fault." Tracy reached out toward Kim. He took her hand and squeezed it. For a few moments, a wordless but powerful communication passed between the two people. Tracy sighed, shook her head in despair, then took her hand back. She twisted around in the seat and started the engine. Before Kim had gotten to the car, she'd already hauled in the antenna. "One thing is for sure," Tracy said while putting the car into gear. "We're getting out of here." "No," Kim said. He reached forward and put a restraining hand on her shoulder. "I've got to go back. I'm going to see this to the end. Now it's for both Becky and Marcia." "Kim, this now involves proven murder," Tracy said evenly. "It's time for the police." "It's only one murder," Kim said, "and one murder pales against the murder of up to 500 kids a year that this industry is guilty of in the name of increased profit." "Responsibility for the children might be hard to prove in court," Tracy said, "but finding the head of a person makes a startlingly clear case." "I found the head, but I don't know where it is now," Kim said. "It was in with the cowheads. But when I slammed the cover, I activated the system to take them away. It's on its way to the renderer, so there'd be no corpus delicti even if we wanted to blow the whistle on Marcia's death. Obviously, my word at the moment means nothing to the police." "They can start their own investigation," Tracy said. "Maybe they'll find other bones." "Even if they did," Kim said, "the issue here is not to prosecute one low-level thug like the guy who tried to kill me. It's the industry I want to do something about." Tracy sighed again and turned off the engine. "But why go back now? You've accomplished what you set out to do. You've learned that it will be easy to document how the meat gets contaminated." Tracy tapped the tape recorder. "This tape alone might be almost as good as a video. I can tell you it's powerful stuff, the way you described what's going on in there. I'm sure Kelly Anderson will jump on it." "I want to go back mainly because I'll be working the 3-11 cleanup, as you heard. I'm hoping that sometime during the shift I can get into the record room. Marcia found what she called a deficiency report that involved the head of a sick animal. She said she was putting it back into the file, and I heard her do it. I want to find that paper." Tracy shook her head in frustration. "You're taking too much of a risk," she said. "If Kelly Anderson gets on the case, let her find the deficiency report." "I don't think I'm taking any risk at this point," Kim said. "The guy with the knife looked me right in the eye in the men's room. If I were to be recognized, that would have been the moment. In fact, I don't even want this gun anymore." Kim struggled to get the pistol out of his pants pocket. He handed it to Tracy. "At least keep the gun," Tracy said. Kim shook his head. "No, I don't want it." "Please," Tracy said. "Tracy, I'm carrying enough stuff with these battery packs," Kim said, "and I think having it is more of a risk than a comfort." Reluctantly, Tracy took the gun and put it down on the car floor. "I can't talk you out of going back in there." "I want to follow this through," Kim said. "It's the least I can do." "I hope you understand that sitting here while you are taking all this risk is driving me crazy." "I can't understand," Kim said. "Why don't you go home and just come back for me at 11? "Oh, no," Tracy said. "That would be worse. At least this way, I can hear what's going on." "Okay," Kim said. "It's your call, but I'd better get back. The lunch break is almost over." Kim got his legs out of the car before leaning back inside. "Can I ask you to do something sometime this afternoon?" he said. "Of course," Tracy said, "as long as I don't have to leave the car." "Would you call Sharing Labs with your cell phone?" Kim asked. "Ask about the results on the meat I dropped off. They should be ready about now." "Fine," Tracy said. Kim gave her shoulder a squeeze. "Thanks," he said before climbing out. He closed the door, waved, and walked away. Derek Lootman slowed down as he neared Tracy's house. The numbers on some of the neighboring houses were not very apparent, and he did not want to drive by. As the house came into view, he saw the Mercedes parked at the head of the drive. Not wishing to block it, Derek did a U-turn and parked across the street. Taking out the information sheet given to him by Shanahan, Derek checked the license number of the Mercedes. His suspicions were substantiated. It was the doctor's car. After going through the same preparations as he'd done outside of Kim's house, Derek emerged into the light rain that had begun to fall. He snapped open a small, collapsible umbrella before taking out his briefcase. With the briefcase in one hand and the umbrella in the other, he crossed the street and glanced into the car. He was surprised to see it there, thinking that it should have been with Kim at his office. Of course, that suggested Kim was not at his office. Derek knew a lot more about Kim now than he did earlier. He knew that he was a cardiac surgeon who was extremely well-regarded. He knew that he was divorced and was paying considerable alimony and child support. What he didn't know was why O'Brien and his boss in the cattle business wanted the man dead. Derek had asked Shanahan that very question and had gotten a vague answer. Derek never wanted to know the details of any of his clients' dealings with a potential mark, but he wanted to know the generalities. It was another way of reducing risk, not only during the hit, but after. He'd tried to press Shanahan, but to no avail. All he was told was that it involved business. The curious thing was that Derek had found no connection between the doctor and cattle or beef, and Derek had found a lot of information in the doctor's desk. Most of Derek's work stemmed from problems involving money in some form or fashion, with competition, gambling, divorce, and unpaid loans leading the list. Most of the people were scum, whether they were clients or marks, and Derek liked it that way. This case seemed significantly different, and a sense of curiosity was added to Derek's other strong emotions. What Derek disliked the most was to be underestimated and taken advantage of. He'd not gotten into the business in the usual way via mob association. He'd been a mercenary in Africa back in the days when there had been good guys and bad guys, before any of the national armies had had any training. Derek climbed the steps to the porch and rang the bell. With Kim's car in the drive, he expected an answer, but there wasn't any. Derek rang again. He turned and surveyed the neighborhood. It was quite different from Kim's. From where Derek was standing, he had a good view of 5 houses and a reasonable view of 4 more. But there was not a lot of activity. The only person he saw was a woman pushing a stroller, and she was heading away from him. Despite a painstaking search of Kim's correspondence and records, Derek had failed to come up with any evidence suggesting the doctor had a gambling problem. So Derek reasoned that gambling couldn't have been the stimulus for Shanahan's offering him the contract. Divorce was out because the former wife had gotten a good settlement. Besides, she and the doctor were apparently getting along fine. Otherwise, she certainly wouldn't have bailed him out of jail, as Shanahan reported. Alone seemed equally unlikely, since there had been no indication in Kim's records that he needed money, and even if he had, why would he borrow from a cattleman? That left competition, but that was the most unlikely of all. Kim didn't even own any stock in the beef industry, except for a few shares in a fast food hamburger chain. It was indeed a mystery. Derek turned around and examined the door. It was secured with a standard throw bolt and lock, a mere inconvenience given his experience. The question was whether there was an alarm. Putting down his briefcase, Derek cupped his hands to peer through the sidelight. He saw no keypad. Taking out his locksmith tools from his left pocket, he made quick work of the locks. The door opened and swung inside. He looked along the inside of the jam. There were no contacts. Stepping within the small foyer, he looked for a keypad on the portion of the walls that he'd not been able to see from the porch. There was none. Then he glanced up around the cornice for motion detectors. He relaxed. There was no alarm. Derek retrieved his briefcase before closing the door. He made a rapid tour of the first floor before climbing to the second. In the guest room, he found a small overnight bag with a shaving kit and clothes he guessed belonged to Kim. In the only bathroom, he found several sets of damp towels. Derek went back downstairs and made himself comfortable in the living room. With Kim's car in the driveway and his things in the guest room, Derek knew that the doctor would be back. It was only a matter of waiting. Carlos butted the unsuspecting Adolfo out of the way and got his time card into the time clock before his partner. It was an ongoing joke they'd been playing for months.
"I'll get you next time," Adolfo joked.
He made a point of speaking in English because Carlos had told him he wanted to learn to speak better.
"Yeah, over my dead body," Carlos replied.
It was one of his favorite new phrases. It had been Adolfo who'd gotten Carlos to come to Higgins and Hancock and then helped him bring his family. Adolfo and Carlos had known each other since they were kids back in Mexico. Adolfo had come to the United States several years before Carlos. The two friends emerged into the afternoon rain, arm in arm. Along with an army of other workers, they headed for their vehicles.
"You want to meet tonight at El Toro?" Adolfo questioned.
"Sure," Carlos said.
"Bring a lot of pesos," Adolfo advised. "You're going to lose a lot of money."
He mimed using a cue stick to shoot pool.
"It will never happen," Carlos said, slapping his partner on the back.
It was at that moment that Carlos saw the black Cherokee with its darkly tinted windows. The vehicle was next to his own, and fumes were rising languidly from its exhaust pipe. Carlos gave Adolfo a final pat on the back. He watched his partner get into his truck before Carlos headed for his own. Carlos took his time and waved to Adolfo as he drove by. At that point, he detoured toward the Cherokee and approached the driver's side window. The window went down. Shanahan smiled.
"I got some good news," he said. "Come around and get in."
Carlos did as he was told. He shut the door behind him.
"You're going to have another chance to do the doctor," Shanahan said.
"I'm very happy," Carlos said. He smiled, too. "When?"
"Tonight," Shanahan said. "The doctor is working here."
"I told you," Carlos said. "I knew it was him."
"There's been a bit of luck," Shanahan said with a nod. "And best of all, he's working the cleanup tonight. It will be arranged that he will clean the men's room next to the record room. Do you know where that is?"
"I don't. I've never been in Higgins and Hancock."
"Yeah, I know where it is," Carlos said. "We're not supposed to use that room."
"Well, tonight you will," Shanahan said with a wry smile. "It will be late, probably after 10. Make sure you're there."
"I'll be there," Carlos promised.
"It should be easy," Shanahan said. "You'll be dealing with an unarmed, unsuspecting person in a small room. Just make sure the body disappears like Marsha Baldwin."
"I do what you say," Carlos said.
"Just don't screw up this time," Shanahan said. "I've gone out on a limb for you, and I don't want to be embarrassed again."
"No problem," Carlos said with emphasis. "Tonight, I kill him."
Chapter 17. Monday night, January 26th. Straightening up with a groan, Kim stretched his back. Abandoning his heavy wooden-handled mop, he put his hands on his hips to get maximum extension. Kim was by himself mopping the front hall, starting from the reception area. He'd had his earphone in for the last 10 minutes, complaining to Tracy how exhausted he was. Tracy was sympathetic. The cleaning had been extensive. The whole crew had started with high-pressure steam hoses on the kill floor. It was back-breaking work, since the hoses weighed several hundred pounds and had to be hauled up onto the catwalks. After the kill floor, they had moved into the boning rooms. Cleaning them had taken the rest of the shift up until the dinner break at 6. At that time, Kim had gone back out to the car and even had had the stomach for some of the lunch he and Tracy had packed that morning. After the dinner break, Kim had been sent out on his own on various jobs around the plant. As the others had slowed down, he'd volunteered to mop the front hall. "I'm never going to complain about surgery being hard work again," he said into his microphone. "After all this experience, I'll hire you to do my house," Tracy quipped. "Do you do windows?" "What time is it?" Kim asked. He was in no mood for humor. "It's a little after 10, Tracy said. "Less than an hour to go. Are you going to make it?" "I'll make it all right," Kim said. "I haven't seen any of my cleaning colleagues for the last hour. It's time for the record room." "Be quick," Tracy urged. "Your being in there is going to make me anxious all over again, and I don't think I can take too much more." Kim stuck the heavy-duty mop into his bucket and pushed the contraption down the hall to the record room door. Its broken central panel was covered by a piece of thin plywood. Kim tried the door. It opened with ease. He reached in and turned on the light. Except for a larger sheet of the same plywood over the sashless window facing the parking lot, the room looked entirely normal. The broken glass and the rock he'd tossed in had all been taken away. The left side of the room had a long line of file cabinets. At random, Kim yanked out the nearest drawer. It was jammed full of files so tightly that not another sheet of paper could have been added. "Gosh," Kim said, "they sure do have a lot of paperwork. This isn't going to be as easy as I'd hoped." The end of an El Producto cigar burned brightly for a few moments and then faded. Elmer Conrad held the resulting smoke in his mouth for a few pleasurable moments and then blew it contentedly at the ceiling. Elmer was the 3-11 cleaning crew supervisor. He'd held the job for 8 years. His idea of work was to sweat like crazy for the first half of the shift and then coast. At the moment, he was in the coasting mode, watching a Sony Watchman in the lunchroom with his feet up on a table. "You wanted to see me, boss?" Harry Perlmutter asked, poking his head into the lunchroom from the back hall. Harry was one of Elmer's underlings.
"Yeah," Elmer said. "Where's that queer-looking temp guy?"
"I think he's out in the front hall mopping," Harry said. "At least that's what he said he was going to do."
"Do you think he cleaned those two bathrooms out there?" Elmer asked.
"I wouldn't know," Harry said. "You want me to check?" Elmer let his heavy feet fall to the floor with a thump. He pushed himself up to his full height. He was over 6'5" and weighed 240 pounds.
"Thanks, but I'll do it myself," Elmer said. "I told him twice he had to clean those heads before 11. If he hasn't done them, he will. He's not leaving here until they're done."
Elmer put down his cigar, took a swig of coffee, and set out to find Kim. What was motivating him was that he'd received specific instructions from the front office that Kim was to clean the bathrooms in question, and he was to clean them alone. Elmer had no idea why he'd gotten such an order, but he didn't care. All he cared about was that it was carried out.
"This isn't going to be so hard after all," Kim said into his microphone. "I found a whole drawer of process deficiency reports. They go from 1988 to the present. Now all I have to do is find January 9th.
"Hurry up, Kim," Tracy said. "I'm starting to get nervous again."
"Relax, Trace," Kim said. "I told you, I haven't seen a soul in an hour. I think they're all back in the lunchroom watching a ball game."
"Ah, here we are. January 9th.
The folder's jammed full."
Kim pulled a clutch of papers from the folder. He turned around and put them down on the library table.
"Pay dirt," Kim said happily. "It's the whole group of papers Marcia talked about."
Kim spread the papers out so that he could see them all.
"Here's the purchase invoice from Bart Winslow for what must have been a sick cow."
Kim glanced through the other papers, finally picking one up.
"Here's what I'm looking for. It's a process deficiency report on the same cow."
"What does it say?" Tracy asked.
"I'm reading it," Kim said. After a moment, he added, "Well, the mystery has been solved. The last cow's head fell off the rail onto the floor. Of course, I know what that means after the work I've been doing today. It probably fell in its own manure and then went in to be butchered for hamburger meat. This cow could have been infected with the E. coli.
That's consistent with what you found out from sharing labs this afternoon, indicating that the patty made from the meat butchered on January 9th was heavily contaminated. In the next instant, Kim was startled enough to let out a whimper. To his utter shock, the process deficiency report was ripped from his hands. He spun around to find himself facing Elmer Conrad. While he'd been talking, he'd not heard the man come into the room.
"What the hell are you doing with these papers?" Elmer demanded.
His broad face had become beet red. Kim felt his heart race. Not only had he been caught looking at confidential documents, but he had the microphone in his right ear. To try to keep the wire out of Elmer's line of sight, he kept his head turned to the right, looking at Elmer out of the corner of his eye.
"You better answer me, boy," Elmer growled.
"They were on the floor," Kim said, desperately trying to think of something. "I was trying to put them back." Elmer glanced at the open drawer to the file cabinet, then back at Kim.
"Who were you talking to?"
"Was I talking?" Kim asked innocently.
"Don't mess with me, boy," Elmer warned.
Kim put his hand on his head, then gestured ineffectually at Elmer, but no words came out of his mouth. He was trying to think of something clever to say, but couldn't.
"Tell him you were talking to yourself," Tracy whispered.
"Okay," Kim said.
"I was talking to myself."
Elmer looked askance at Kim, almost the same way Kim was looking at Elmer.
"You sounded like you were having a goddamn conversation," Elmer said.
"I was," Kim offered.
"Just with myself. I do it all the time when I'm alone."
"You're one weird dude," Elmer said.
"What's wrong with your neck?"
Kim rubbed the left side of his neck with his left hand.
"It's a little stiff," he said.
"Too much mopping, I guess."
"Well, you got some more to do," Elmer said. "Remember those two restrooms next door here? Remember I told you that you had to clean them?"
"I guess that did slip my mind," Kim said. "Sorry, but I can get right to it."
"I don't want you doing a crappy job," Elmer said. "So take your time, even if you have to work past 11. Understand?"
"They'll be pristine," Kim promised. Elmer tossed the process deficiency report onto the table and roughly pushed all the papers together. While he was occupied, Kim pulled the earphone out of his ear and tucked it under his shirt. It felt good to straighten his neck out.
"We'll leave these papers for the secretaries to deal with," Elmer said.
He reached over to the file cabinet and pushed the open drawer shut.
"Now get the hell out of here. You're not supposed to be in here in the first place."
Kim preceded Elmer out of the room. Elmer hesitated at the door to look around one final time. Only then did he put out the light and close the door. Taking out a large ring of keys, he locked it. Kim was busy rinsing out his mop when Elmer turned to him.
"I'm going to keep my eye on you, boy," Elmer warned, "and I'm going to come back and inspect these two restrooms after you're done, so don't cut corners."
"I'll do my best," Kim said. Elmer gave him one final disapproving look before heading back toward the lunchroom. This book is continued on Cassette 8, Side 1.